about the earth, really talk about survival. We could talk about the poles where the cold is unrivaled. The Arctic top of the world got people and polar bears. Antarctica, crazy penguins chilling down there on miles and miles of ice and glaciers. But something ain't straight with our polar neighbors. It's a change in the climate, a change in the weather. It's heating up now, but it's not for the better. See, the heat comes down from the sun to the earth, but now the heat can't escape, it just can't disperse because of carbon dioxide from power plants and factories, causing trucks so much more than you could find naturally. So the poles get warm and the earth gets hotter. All that necessary ice melts down underwater. And the impact, the sad fact, is it can only escalate. So for real, we gotta act now before it's too late.
Take aim at climate change.
Gotta take aim, y'all.
Take aim at climate change.
Take
aim at climate change.
The catch, it's not all that obvious, but changes in the north and south are gonna affect all of us. That's why we got polar adventurers, measure the thickness of the ice and checking the earth's temperatures. We're life, that ice is the earth's refrigerator, but when it starts to melt, it will be felt at the equator. Peep, when glaciers melt, the ocean starts swelling, and then they flood the coast where the people be dwelling. You could say peace to Florida, New York, and California, all drowning in the ocean.
Don't say we didn't warn you.
Real, all it takes is a couple degrees before floods, droughts, and hurricanes are not anomalies.
And all these catastrophes become our new realities, coming down on the world just like the sword of Damocles.
Take aim at climate change.
Gotta all work together.
Take aim at climate change. Take aim at climate change.
Gotta all work together.
Take aim at climate change.
Okay, I get it, but give me some credit. So the world needs rescue. What can I do?
Just one small positive act and then another, and then add them all together, one after the other. Come on, you know the drill, it's about conservation, using only what you need and making sure that you're not wasting. Lots of information can be found on the web, so educate your head and don't forget to let your knowledge spread.
Is that all?
Not even close, that's not the end of it, but a million small things can produce immense benefits. Any way you call it, there's no single way to solve it. We gotta have involvement before the earth becomes insolvent.
Adapt to a new situation. Innovate, use your imagination. Mitigate, we've got to try.
Discoveries and new questions to ask, cause we can figure out the future by examining the past. So we sail to the poles and sample the extremes and drill into the ice and discover what it means. So use that brain and make science a priority, and you can work on stopping global warming with authority. So act now, there's no time for games. It's time to take aim.
Mitigate, we've got to try to stop global warming. We've got to inhale.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Scott Horton interviews Eric Margolies. Eric Margolies discusses Egypt's fake revolution. He comments on the criminal charges against former Pakistani President Musharraf and reminds us of the still unsolved mystery of who really killed Benazir Bhutto. And then after that, how close are we to the edge? As food prices rise and civil unrest builds throughout the Middle East, Lester Brown wonders if these two could be connected.
Well,
actually, hold it right there about the Muslim Brotherhood, because, I mean, obviously the first point is worth emphasizing, that these are conservatives, not radicals. They're, you know, this is why Zawahiri hates them, is because they're more or less content with the status quo. They certainly aren't, you know, bottom-up Leninist-style revolutionaries like the Al-Qaeda types are. But then the other thing is, it seems like, at least so far, they were playing their card pretty smart and saying, I don't know if just for public relations purposes or if their K Street lobbyists, you know, recommended it or what, but they said, hey, what if we got Mohammed el-Baradei to kind of be our guy to support and negotiate for us and that kind of thing, because, of course, he may not be acceptable to, you know, the anti-Iran hardliners in America, you know, their bad feelings over the past few years when he was the director of the IAEA. But other than that, you know, he's a worldly kind of guy and part of the UN establishment, acceptable to the so-called international community. And, you know, I wonder if they're going to continue to play it like that. And I wonder whether you think that other than them, whether Mohammed el-Baradei will amount to anything. I really like him just because all those times that he reported that the agency has continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose, which was the all-important truth in debunking the claim that they're making nuclear weapons over there and that we got to have a war against them.
Well, he's an honest man, and he has integrity. I don't know how far he's going to get in politics with those qualities, but he's not popular in Egypt. Most people don't even know him, but the Muslim Brotherhood was very smart in getting behind him and saying he'll represent us, and they made a point of saying that they have no major political ambition to take over the government at this point. As you say, Scott, this is clearly one of their intentions, is not to alarm Washington, which might intervene more heavily to support Mubarak if they had said that. What they're going to do remains to be seen. There are different factions within the Muslim Brotherhood. So far, the very conservative factions are dominant, and the Brotherhood very much resembles the Turkey's AK party, ruling AK party of Prime Minister Erdogan, in being a very moderate central Democrat party, sort of like Europe's Christian Democrats, that wants to bring in Islamic values, meaning social welfare, better education, help for the poor, all this kind of thing, sharing more of the wealth rather than cutting off people's heads and building a caliphate in Northern Virginia, as American conservatives have been panicked into thinking.
Well, now, the other thing, too, about the Muslim Brotherhood is there's only, what, a couple of 10,000 of them or something in a country of millions of people, and this revolution was really led by the youth who are secularist, you know, types who, you know, don't want anything to do, I don't think, with religious fundamentalism, radical or conservative.
Well, that's quite right. But, you know, this is partly our fault in the U.S. because we allowed, encouraged, and financed Mubarak and all our other Arab dictators to crush all opposition. There was a party started by one man, Mr. Ayman Nour, who actually had the temerity to run against the Mubarak in one of his rigged elections. He got beaten up and thrown into jail, and his few supporters were beaten up, too, and got in serious trouble with the government. So there's really nothing in the center. And what worries me so much in these countries is we are creating a self-fulfilling prophecy and saying that, you know, we can't deal with anybody who has the word Muslim in their name because there's so much anti-Muslim hysteria in the United States. Egypt's a Muslim country. It's like the Egyptians saying to us, hey, we won't deal with anybody who's a Christian in your country. It's crazy. But what we're doing, if we don't allow the moderate center to come forth, then we're going to get the underground forces that we really worry about and who may be very extreme.
Yeah, shades of back in the day when the CIA was providing Saddam Hussein with the lists of people with glasses to kill like it was Pol Pot, and, you know, back in the Reagan days, we were in on his game.
If I were looking for an executive headhunter for recruiting executives, I would not turn to the CIA. They've had a deplorable record. When you think of not a Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, think of how many other Arab dictators and other dictators around the world who they've picked. Not good choices.
All right, well, speaking of which, the CIA was attempting to install Benazir Bhutto after General Musharraf was forced out in Pakistan, and then she got bombed, and they said it was Al-Qaeda, and then the footage came out, and she got shot before she got bombed, and then you know, there are different reports blaming it on, you know, who knows, Taliban, whatever. Now, there's apparently been a warrant issued for former General Musharraf's arrest, although apparently he's safe in London. I bet you they extradite Assange before him, but I wonder whether you think, well, what do you think?
Well, this is great personal, emotional impact on me because I knew Benazir Bhutto very well. I was in constant contact with her, and in fact, I was on talking to her just 6 days before she was killed, telling her to be extra careful. And I never believed for a moment that it was the Pashtuns or somebody else who killed her. Obviously, there was some kind of government plot. But now, what Musharraf is being charged with is not complicity in trying to kill her. He's being charged by a Pakistani court, where Pakistan has a totally rotten justice system, having failed to provide her adequate security. And this may, in fact, be the case. It could be part of a plot against her. I don't think anything is going to come of this charge, but it's also designed to keep him out of Pakistan, and because he's been threatening to come back and run for office, though I think his popularity is, I think an Indian candidate would probably fare better in Pakistan than old Mush right now.
Well, but do you think there's anything to it, that he would be in on the plot against Benazir Bhutto?
I don't think so. My gut just tells me that that Musharraf would not have done that. She told me, Benazir told me on the six days before she died, that if she was killed, that she said the people who would do it were a very prominent family called the Chaudhrys in Punjab province in Pakistan, who were one of the big sort of economic fat cats there, who were major supporters of Musharraf. Take your guess. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out who assassinated my old friend Zia-ul-Haq, the president of Pakistan, and that was in the late 1980s, and we still don't have any answers, so I don't know if we'll get anything on Benazir Bhutto either.
Well, so what about her husband? I mean, it's funny the way I see in the press that the parliamentary system there and all the politicians that are part of it have virtually no support among the people, and yet they still seem to have one. Is it just a fake front for the military, like, say,
yes,
for example, Mubarak's pinstripes in Egypt a
yes,
few
exactly.
weeks ago?
Yeah, Pakistan's parliament's a talking jabber house. If you any big landowner gets to be in parliament. So in parliament, they're just bought and sold. It's meaningless. It's just a facade to keep the Americans happy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sorry that we're all out of time. As always, we end before I'm done asking you questions, but that's the way it is. I appreciate your time on the show. We'll talk to you again soon, Eric.
Cheers, Scott.
Everybody, that's Eric Margolies. He's the author of American Raj. He writes for LouRockwell.com, and his own website is ericmargolies.com. At LRC Today, Egypt's faux revolution, bait and switch on the Nile.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
A recent World Bank study notes that food prices have soared nearly 30% just in the past year. Meanwhile, many autocratic regimes in the Middle East that have ruled for decades have suddenly become unstable as citizens take to the streets demanding change. This is not a coincidence, says Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute. He writes that rich nations are adding to the social instability when they buy up land in poor nations to guarantee their own food supply. Lester Brown is a MacArthur Fellow and the author of more than 50 books. His latest is World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. He spoke with Living on Earth's Steve Kerwood.
What's driving the current spike in world food prices? How is this related to rising population, recent crazy weather events? What's behind all this?
On the demand side, we now have three sources of growing demand for grain. One, population growth. The second thing is rising affluence. There are probably close to 3 billion people in the world today who want to move up the food chain and consume more grain-intensive livestock products, meat, milk, and eggs. The third thing is we're now converting substantial quantities of grain into oil, i.e. ethanol. And what we're seeing now is that the world's farmers are having trouble keeping up with the growth in demand. But on the supply side, climate change. It used to be if we had a weather event someplace, a monsoon failure in India or drought in the former Soviet Union or what have you, we knew that if we could get through the next year that things would go back to normal. But there's no norm to go back to now. The world's climate is in a constant state of flux.
You mentioned climate change. Temperatures are rising around the world. How do crops and other plants react to this?
Well, the rule of thumb is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, that's 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields.
So even the present target that some people talk about, it, keeping the warming to less than 2 degrees centigrade, is going to result in a 20% cut in our productivity for food on the planet? In the best case scenario that people talk about.
If that comes during the growing season, that's what we're looking at.
What would have happened if we'd had a drought or heat wave like they had in Russia last year?
It's a useful question with a disturbing answer, because if the heat wave that was centered in Moscow had instead been centered in Chicago, and we had lost 40% of our grain harvest as the Russians did, we would have lost 160 million tons, not 40 million tons. If that had happened, there would now be chaos in world grain markets. Food prices would have been rising throughout the world. Grain exporting countries would have restricted exports to keep their food prices down, reducing the exportable supplies. Most likely, the oil exporting countries would have begun to barter oil for grain to make sure they could get the grain they needed. And much of the rest of the world, including many lower income developing countries, would have been left scrambling for the remaining crumbs. And that would have led to governments falling, food riots and demonstrations on a scale that we've not seen before. Because when people get really desperate, they do desperate things.
How much do you think food and water issues are playing in the present instability in Egypt and other countries in the Middle East?
It's hard to sort out, unemployment and rising food prices and frustrations of having a totalitarian government. But there's no question that of all economic indicators, I think the most politically sensitive is food prices. In Egypt, interestingly, we have a country importing over half of the grain it consumes and producing the other smaller half, if you will, with imported water via the Nile River. The difficulty now is with all the land grabs, land acquisitions by the Chinese, the Koreans, the Saudis, and many other countries, in the countries in the Upper Nile River Basin, like the Sudan and Ethiopia, when they acquire that land, they also acquire water in the upper part of the Nile Basin, which means there will be less water for Egypt to produce food with. So Egypt is faced with growing insecurity in its food supply, both because of the competition for imports and also because it's going to be getting less water coming down the Nile.
In your book, you mention what you call a water-based food bubble. Can you please explain that?
Well, as the demand for food has been increasing throughout the world, many countries have expanded irrigation, even though it meant overpumping their aquifers. And if it's a fossil aquifer, it doesn't recharge. Then once you've depleted it, it's finished. And that's what's happened in Saudi Arabia. That's why their wheat production has collapsed in the last few years and will disappear entirely in the next year or two.
But there are not a lot of people in Saudi Arabia.
No, but there are a lot of people in India. And in India, most of the aquifers are replenishable aquifers. So if you overpump there, when you deplete the aquifer, the rate of pumping is necessarily reduced to the rate of recharge. And that's what countries like India and China are facing.
What's the food situation in those two countries, and how might that impact the U.S.?
Both countries are vulnerable because of overpumping. It now looks as though China's going to be coming into the world market this year for substantial quantities of grain. They will almost certainly come to the United States because the United States is far and away the world's leading grain exporter. So for American consumers, this is a nightmare scenario because we're looking at the prospect of 1.4 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes competing with us for our grain harvest, driving up our food prices. Now you can say, well, if they drive up our food prices too much, we'll restrict exports. But China's our banker. They're holding $900 billion of U.S. Treasury securities. Like it or not, we are going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese, regardless of how much it drives up food prices.
Care to predict how much more it could cost us?
we are somewhat insulated because if we buy a loaf of bread for $2, for example, the cost of the wheat in that loaf of bread is maybe 10 cents. So the price of wheat doubles, you add another 10% onto the loaf of bread. But if you live in northern India or Pakistan and you buy your wheat in the market, bring it home and then grind it into flour so you can make chapatis, if the price of wheat doubles, you feel it directly. That's the difference between the developing world and the industrialized world.
So if the phone were to ring, Lester Brown, and it's the White House, they would like to get a briefing on what one might do in the face of the world food situation. What would you tell them? And in particular, how would you define our security?
I would first of all say that this current situation, unlike the price surges in the last half of the last century, is not event-driven. It is trend-driven. That doesn't mean that events like the heat wave in Russia won't affect it, but it is trend-driven. So we have to look at those trends and we have to deal with them. And it includes things like cutting carbon emissions very fast to stabilize climate. It means eradicating poverty and accelerating the shift to smaller families around the world. It means restoring the economy's natural support systems with forests and soils and aquifers and grasslands and fisheries. And no civilization has ever survived the ongoing destruction of its natural support systems, Mr. President, nor will ours. What we are now faced with is a need to redefine security. We have inherited a definition of security from the last century, which was dominated by two world wars and the Cold War. And so when you mention national security in the United States, people automatically think military. But if you were to sit down with a clean slate today and say, what are the leading threats to our future? It is climate change. It is population growth. It is falling water tables. It is rising food prices. It is failing states. I would say, Mr. President, we not only need to redefine security in a conceptual sense, but also in a fiscal sense. Because what's needed to eradicate poverty, stabilize population, restore soils and forests and all these things, comes to about $200 billion of additional expenditures a year. That's a lot. But it's less than a third of the U.S. military budget, and it's less than a seventh of the global military budget. So the question is, can civilization, as we know it, survive these mounting stresses if we don't get some of the trends generating the stresses turned around?
So what you're saying, in essence, is security isn't a matter of guns so much anymore as it is butter.
Bread.
Bread and butter.
Bread and butter, yeah. That's the message, Mr. President.
I know people ask you this. What can they do on an individual level?
That's the question I get more frequently than any other. And I think people expect me to say, you know, change your light bulbs and recycle your newspapers. And those things are important. But we now have to change the system. I don't mean a political revolution. I mean we have to restructure the world economy in a way that will dramatically reduce carbon emissions. It's going to take a lot of political support. So it's becoming politically active. Pick an issue that's important to you. If it's creating a world-class recycling program in your community or helping to close coal-fired power plants or joining a population group to stabilize world population, this is where our future is going to be determined.
Lester Brown's new book is called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Thank you so much.
Steve, my pleasure. Thank you for focusing attention on these issues.
That's Lester Brown talking with Living on Earth's Steve Kerwood.
Again. where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
That's all, folks.